This is Karin Zessus of ASCOA Online. It's only been a few weeks since Joe Biden took office, and already we're seeing shifts in policy towards Central America. The new administration pledged a $4 billion aid package to the region and canceled a series of Trump-era migration pacts with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But if some moves have struck a cordial tone, others suggest relations are under review. For example, in February, the White House reportedly snubbed a meeting request with El Salvador's popular president, Nayib Bukele. And this comes just as the country prepares for legislative elections.
It is my belief that what Biden does and what the Biden administration does will be the only real opposition in El Salvador.
In this episode, my colleague Chase Harrison talks with Nelson Rauda, a reporter at El Faro, to discuss what the shift away from Trump's quid pro quo politics means for U.S. relationships with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Nelson.
I'm very glad you invited me. Thank you so much.
So before we start to talk about what policy towards Central America will look like under President Joe Biden, I thought it would be appropriate to start by talking about what relations were like under President Trump. Could you tell me a little bit about President Trump's policy towards Central America and perhaps what his legacy will be in the region?
Well, some legacy, you know. I don't actually think we can define the relationship by other word than extortive. When the Guatemalan government made the smallest protest over the asylum agreements signed during 2019, 2020, Trump angrily tweeted that they would consider taxing the remittances, the money sent back to their country from Guatemalans in America. And that's not a relationship at all. That's blackmailing. There's no negotiation possible when that happens. And Juan Orlando Hernandez, Honduras president, wasn't really interested in anything else than himself trying to get himself or saving himself from going to prison. The clearest policy for El Salvador's president Nayib Bukele during his first years was a submission to Washington. He didn't have any problem. So I think that those relationships were, they have always been on a pair level, like Central American governments have never been treated as equals by American governments. But it was very aggressive. It was very, if you do not do what I want you to do, there is no relationship in this. And it was always remarkable for me when all American media were focused on Trump's first impeachment. I don't know if you remember, but the then chief of cabinet or interim chief of cabinet, Mick Mulvaney, came out to an NBC reporter or something and accepted that they were holding aid money for the Northern Triangle countries to press for changes in immigration. And he said that, and he said to, like, get over it, it happens. And everybody was shocked because he was admitting the famous quid pro quo about Ukraine. But nobody cared for Central American countries, you know? Nobody cared that this was happening for Central American countries. As if it was normal, as if it was normal thing for American governments to treat Central America that way, but God forbids they do it to a European, mostly white country. So that's how I remember the Trump years.
Aside from a souring of the perception of the United States in Central America, could you describe on the ground what changes made to Central American policy under the Trump administration felt like? So I'm thinking about policies, like you mentioned, that forced Central American countries to process migrants before the United States would.
There's two sides of this. One is the real changes and one are the supposed changes, because Mr. Trump's presidency was very showbiz. So there was always half-truths to what he said and to what he did. The real change we saw on the ground was the MPP, the Remain in Mexico policy. It effectively shut down the asylum system. Basically, there was no way that you could get an asylum in the U.S. if you came from Central America or if you didn't arrive by plane to the U.S., which is not the case for the majority of the immigrants. And it allowed all governments to say that immigration arrests on the U.S. south border had gone down. And of course they had gone down because the border moved south. There were many, many Central Americans who were being detained and deported from Mexico. So for El Salvador, the numbers went up in the deportations that were coming from Mexico, and they went down in the ones that were coming from the United States. It's true that there was a decrease in numbers, like a general decrease in numbers, but you have to acknowledge that Mexico took a bigger role, and even Guatemala took a bigger role in stopping caravans, as we have seen this January. And that kind of change, that involved other changes for people, for the migrants on the ground, because it made the road more dangerous. If there are more policemen, if there are more eyes watching the main roads, you have to take dangerous roads over the mountains, down to valleys, rivers, crossing jungles, and that was more dangerous for the immigrants. And it was also more expensive because more eyes, meaning that the smugglers, the coyotes, have to pay more people on the way. So that made the trip more expensive for the people who are still doing the journey. But there was another part of the Trump policies that was only for show and pictures. I mean, the asylum agreements with Honduras and El Salvador never really started. Not one person was sent to search for asylum, neither in Honduras or in El Salvador. And they have now been canceled, or at least the Biden administration announced they were going to cancel them. And you know, it made sense because between 2014 and 2019, 6 years, only 150 persons applied for asylum in El Salvador. And the country only granted 33 of them. It means the amount of people that asks for asylum in El Salvador is not really significant. And the office that works on the asylum cases in El Salvador only has 9 employees. So it was always going to be a challenge for them to implement those kind of policies. And I think that's part of the reason why they never started. But I also think other part of the reason is that the Trump administration was very interested in the picture and in showing an image of being a strong-willed, strong man with these countries and law and order and all that kind of things. And they didn't really follow through on it. I guess it was part of their plan.
So you referenced that Biden has already effectively repealed the asylum agreements with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. I'm curious if, besides that or inclusive of that, already there's a feeling of shift with the Trump administration to the Biden administration a month now into Biden's presidency?
Absolutely. Bukele being turned down in Washington was last week's topic in San Salvador. And there's an absolute change to the last ambassador, to Mr. Ronald Johnson, who used to share both weekends and lobster dinners with President Bukele. That's an absolute change. Even 2 years ago, if you remember, it's not been that long when Bukele was at an interview in Council of the Americas or at an interview in the Heritage Foundation. And everybody was like charmed by him. He had all of the media, all of the politicians feeding off his hand. So that's quite a change when you go to a city and they don't even have meetings with you. And it's not only that, but Bukele was checking all the right boxes when he came into Washington. He made a speech to be liked. You know, he was in Washington talking, and especially at Heritage Foundation, talking about free market, limited government, freedom of expressions, democracy, mistalking or talking badly about China and Venezuela. And then 2 years later, we're here because messages for the defense of democracy in El Salvador are coming from all kinds of different actors, from former Ambassador Mari Carmen Aponte, Representative Norma Torres, Juan Gonzalez, former assistant to Obama Dan Restrepo. It is changing. It's not only El Salvador. The mounting case against Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, it seems like the circle is closing in on him, on the drug investigations. And the Department of State warning against the election of a Supreme Court justice in Guatemala, May Normoto. This all adds up, and we are seeing a much more active Biden administration than what we used to see in Mr. Trump's administration.
The example you bring up of Bukele being denied a meeting recently in Washington with President Biden is interesting because it seems that foreign leaders have to adhere or try to match up to the standards set by the U.S. president in terms of how to operate in the foreign affairs arena. What kind of expectations do you think President Biden will have for Central American leaders? What is he looking for when he makes decisions in regards to the region around questions like migration, foreign aid or corruption, for example?
I think we have to be pretty blunt in the assessment. I don't buy that an American government has the best interest of Central American countries, Latin American countries in mind when they take decisions. I mean, it was the other guy's slogan, but it has always been America first. That's always been the case. But there are certain interests in common for American governments and Central American governments. And obviously, immigration numbers being down is something that it's common ground for these governments. And so Biden administration and Biden himself will want to avoid a repeat of the miners crisis in the border, like they had in the Obama years. Or they will want to avoid the caravans, which got them a lot of criticism from the right. So immigration is the big target, I think. And democracy is a pushing factor for people out of their countries. When things go bad in Honduras, when police repression amounts, when crime surges, I mean, all the climate of political uncertainty in Guatemala doesn't allow businesses to thrive, doesn't allow investments to grow. The same applies for El Salvador. So it is in their best interest that the democracies in Central America are healthy, because that will avoid immigration surges, that will not eliminate immigration by itself, but that it will at least eliminate one factor. I wrote that in a recent column for El Faro English, which is our English version. I think democracy is one of the pushing factors that could throw the El Salvador into a full-blown crisis again. The pandemic has not been easy for any country. The economy is not recovering as quickly as possible. Security issues are always a concern in El Salvador, even though homicides are significantly down. But security is always a concern. And if you add a democracy in danger to that mix, nothing good will come out of it. So I think they will want to have strong institutions, strong states, good elections, people happy, not contributing to a climate of political uncertainty, because that drives away investments. And I think that's what they will try to do.
One area where we've seen recent developments with the U.S. trying to lessen something like corruption and promote democracy in Central America is with recent lawsuits and convictions of Central Americans in the United States. I'm thinking particularly of recent charges against Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, and also recent lawsuits against MS-13, the Salvadoran gang, in the United States. How are those kinds of judicial developments being received within the region?
Well, you know, I cannot say that much. I'm not that particularly invested in the Honduran political context. But what I can say is that it seems to me that Washington's patience with the Partido Nacional in Honduras has run down. Partido Nacional, of course, being Juan Orlando's party and the official party in power for close to a decade. It seems that even when Juan Orlando's brother was being tried and was convicted in a New York court, Juan Orlando used to make appearances in Washington. He was running up the hills, like by the Washington Memorial, or having his pictures taken with Trump officials, as if to say, there's nothing sketchy going on here, even if his name was being mentioned in court records. And Trump allowed that. And Trump allowed that because Honduras had signed the asylum agreement and had been very, very silent, and had been almost in a competition to see who was the best fit kisser between Juan Orlando and Bukele, who was the best suck-up to the Trump administration. So it seems that Washington's patience has run down, and we're seeing changes. And it would be very strange if those accusations didn't amount to Juan Orlando actually being charged for drug charges in the United States. And that, of course, plays part in the Honduran campaign, in the Honduran election. That plays exactly into a narrative of the opposition in Honduras. And it's a way, even if they're not intending it that way, the United States know that this affects the Partido Nacional campaign in Honduras. And, of course, in El Salvador, it makes other questions. We at El Faro revealed the accords, the political accords between MS-13 and Bukele's administration. And when the United States makes a destination, they name-checked two of gang members that we have also mentioned in our investigation. So it brings us to a question. If you remember, the communication from the U.S. government said that extradition was on the table. There was a possibility of these gang members being brought to justice in the United States. So there are questions to be asked there. What happens, for instance, if these gang members are brought to the U.S., what does that mean for the agreements between MS-13 and Bukele's administration? Will they resist it in order to keep those agreements in place? And also, it's the whole messaging from Washington has changed. His options are running down, and he's going to have to find an answer to get on the Democrats' good side or to find an alternative. And I go back to what he said in 2019. He didn't rule out the China option. He didn't rule out the China alternative. And he did say that when someone leaves an empty space, someone else fills it. So it's still early stages of that. We don't know how is he going to react with the United States new administration. It's not going well. They are paying hundreds of taxpayers' dollars to lobbyists in Washington, and it's not working out. But it's still early to see, and of course, Bukele has another concern in mind, which is the elections at the end of this month. And I think that probably has a bigger place on his mind right now than what it's going to play out with the U.S., but it's certainly something that he will have to address shortly.
So I'd love to talk about the upcoming legislative elections in El Salvador, which will be on February 28th. How is the U.S. relationship with El Salvador playing into that election? Is it a factor on voters' minds?
Not really. I wouldn't think so. The election has been a game over for almost since Bukele took power, you know, because when Bukele won in 2019, it was the first step of the decadence of the two huge political parties, the traditional and the civil war parties in El Salvador, the ARENA, the right wing, related to Death Squad's ARENA, and the former guerrilla in FMLN. So Bukele is their asteroid, if they are the dinosaurs. He's the meteorite. But Bukele is also a son of that system. He is a former mayor of FMLN, and he is what came out of that marriage. You know, it's parties that have a lot of corruption, a lot of gang accords, a lot of crime, a lot of accusations. And there are dozens of officials right now that are in Bukele's government and are talking badly of ARENA and FMLN, but come directly from them. And there's a lot of recycling in his cabinet. The U.S. relations, what he's discussing right now is a damage to Bukele's image. And if you want to say that is a factor in the elections, then yes, it is, because the whole campaign of Bukele's party is vote for the N in Nayib. His party, his logo is a letter N, as in Nayib. And there are not heated debates about policies. There are not heated debates about which plan is better to recover the jobs, to boost the economy, to deal with migration, to deal with drugs. There are not propositions in this campaign. It's all for Nayib or against Nayib, and he's the center of the campaign. So in the way that he going to Washington and getting shut down, it damages his image, and that plays, but kind of indirectly, to the campaign. But it's not a factor, and it's not going to be a factor, I don't think. The real question in these elections is not if Nayib will win, but by how much they will win, if they will have the simple majority or the qualified majority of the Congress. But I don't think it's a doubt on anybody's mind who will win this election. The opposition is scattered, it's all over the place, and there's not a real project of opposition. It's not a real project of, if you ask me right now, who's going to run in the opposition against Bukele's party or Bukele himself. We don't know if he's going to do something with the re-election, which is now prohibited, but it was also prohibited in Honduras, and Juan Orlando is still there, you know. But there's not a real candidate or a real driving force that's going to come up against Bukele in 3 years. These elections, I think, are pretty much cold and just waiting to happen.
In the scenario where Bukele significantly increases his majority in the legislature, what does that mean for the way he interacts with the United States? Will he be emboldened to act differently?
I think he will be emboldened to act the same. It is my belief that what Biden does and what the Biden administration does will be the only real opposition in El Salvador. Because, you know, after the elections, this coming Congress, this coming legislative assembly has two tasks. It has to elect 5 of the 15 members of the Supreme Court, including the president, and it has to elect a new attorney general. And of course, the current attorney general will not be reelected. He already said that he's not running, but if he was, he will not have the votes in a Bukele-controlled assembly. So that actually raises a question for the democracy in Salvador. Bukele has the army. Bukele has the police, the national police. And both of them have been on the way and have obstructed justice in different cases, in civil war cases, like the investigation at the Mozote massacre in 1981, a famous case which I'm sure rings a bell for many people in the United States. And also in current investigations about corruption in the pandemic, corruption in the pandemic shopping by the health ministry and other governmental offices. And both police and army have obstructed that. The Supreme Court, with the exception of the Constitutional Court, it has been almost non-challenging to Bukele. And that will, of course, not change and almost be more on his side when he gets to elect, or his party gets to elect, five of its members. It will also maybe change the correlations in the votings in the Supreme Court. Having a different Attorney General Raúl Melara, I think we can judge his performances and his actings in two different moments, after Biden and before Biden, because after Biden, he was very shy, very timid, very modest on his public speaking. And after Biden, and this is an anecdote, but the Monday after Biden won, the Attorney General raided the offices of the Ministry of Health and another 10, I think, government buildings in a pandemic corruption investigation. So it's obviously that he is a piece and he is an obstacle for the Bukele takeover of power. I don't know how it plays out when he doesn't have an opposition, Salvador, because the only opposition will be like civil society and political parties. And there's not a clear path in which political parties will be able to really obstruct him on the legislative assembly. The most likely scenario as of right now is that he will control it. He will absolutely control it. And this will be something that we have never seen since the peace accords. No party has had that much control, that much of a majority. How does that play out? He can do all kinds of things. He can promote constitutional reform, which his vice president is already doing, talking about the terms of the presidential term and the possibility of re-election, which is now prohibited, but they are looking into it. The military role in politics, which is allegedly now is non-existent, at least on the paper, and that is going to change, and that could change on the paper too. The use of the police and other government offices to pursue political opposition or enemies, and he has already said that he considers journalists his enemies. So it begs a question for what's going to happen to freedom of expression in Salvador if it's already suffering so many attacks. Like, the attacks on journalists have tripled from Bukele's last year to the FMLN's last year. So it is a very complicated horizon, what I see, and that is why it's very important that people in Washington, policymakers, pay attention to what he's doing. And I think they are that has already started, and they have already started seeing that. I'm not calling, I want to be away from calling to interventionism, but we all know how politics work. And we all know, as I say, that it's not in the best interest of the U.S. that El Salvador democracy goes out.
Another country in the region that has an upcoming election is Honduras, which will elect a new president in November of 2021. Do you get the sense that the dynamics there in regards to the U.S. are similar, or are they going to play out differently in that election?
I think Honduras, the U.S. is a more important factor in the Honduran election than it will be here, because of what I previously stated. But in Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez doesn't have the backing. He is not nearly as popular as Bukele. On the contrary, he has been a president of a country that has gone up in flames against his re-election bid and against his dealing and his getting rid of the constitutional prohibition. So pretty much at this point and at this stage, anything that can ignite again those flames, can ignite against those torches in Honduras, will be used by the opposition, but also by civil society, to do away with the with Juan Orlando's party and his political party. And I think it plays out in a bigger way, in a bigger factor. Honduras has been waiting for an opportunity to get rid of Juan Orlando. This resignation has been called for a number of years from a number of different voices. And now there's an opportunity. And that's why the Honduran elections are so important, because Juan Orlando knows that and his party knows that. And they know that what they have at stake in the polls is not just the political future of the country, but also their own future and their own fate. What will happen if the opposition wins in Honduras and there's a case of drug trafficking against Juan Orlando in New York? What do you think is going to happen? They know that. That's why the stakes are so high in the Honduran elections this year.
Thank you so much. That was so excellent. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Katie Hopkins. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Learn about upcoming concerts online at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word by giving us 5 stars, writing a review, and subscribing at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.